Welcome to Pharma Talk Radio. I'm Valerie Bowling. Pharma Talk Radio is a nonprofit program to disseminate helpful information to those in life sciences, and in particular, drug development and drug delivery. This podcast is a recording from the opening presentation at the inaugural Drug Delivery West Conference on key trends in drug delivery with an expert perspective from Dr. Randall Marsney, Professor's Chair, Department of Pharmacy and Pharmacology at the University of Bath.
Thank you for the invitation. For full disclosure, those of you who don't know, that's my wife. So I was lucky to get an invitation, I think. Because it was dodgy for a while there. I was kind of, yeah, maybe, maybe not. But I do want to thank the organizers very much for the opportunity to speak to you today. And what I'm going to talk about is, I think to set the stage for a meeting like this, is we have to think about the realities of what drug delivery can achieve. There's a great deal of things in the history of the industry where, you know, pharmaceutical companies have an opportunity to deliver a drug, and they develop this drug, and then they assume that it has the ability to just do this magical thing of entering the body by whatever way that it's envisioned by that individual, and not the realities of the body or the physics or the physiology or anything that's related to what actually happens once it hits the body. So what I'm going to talk about today is GI work and the things that we've been doing both in my academic lab and also with the idea of how to understand where you go from here in terms of what possibilities we have. We've been looking both at small peptide delivery and macromolecule delivery, and there's really two different strategies I think you can consider for each of those, if I'm doing this right. So one of the things that we have to pay attention to is the idea that you have two routes, basically, through this epithelia. You have routes between adjacent epithelial cells called the paracellular route, and then you have an opportunity to go through cells, this route here, through a transcytotic pathway. And in one, it's vesicular mediated. That's a transcytotic one. And that's regularly, I'll show you, it's very highly regulated. And the other one is paracellular transport. And that is turns out to be actually also regulated. People always thought that you could just open those barriers up and things would flush through. And unfortunately, you can actually, and that causes a lot of pathology when you do that. And that's correlated with a lot of disease outcomes. So it's not such a good idea to just open that barrier up and let everything flush through that's in the intestinal lumen. But the body has actually defined ways to do this. So what the goal of my research has been in my lab and the company is to understand the nature by which Mother Nature allows you to do these things, get things into the body, because there are tricks that are available to us to do that. And also to appreciate the fact that when you think about this location here, you can see that the opportunities to deliver things between adjacent epithelial cells, where it's marked out in red there, versus the surface area of where you go through cells, is quite dramatic, quite different. And so you have to keep that in mind as well. That's part of the physics of the system. And so one of the things that we've looked at in terms of getting through the tight junction is to understand, and that's the paracellular route, is to understand how Mother Nature opens and closes that all the time. Our barriers are constantly under renovation. They're constantly being attacked by their environment, so they have to be dynamic and be able to regulate their environment and respond to that environment and send entire cells through that compartment, through that route, to actually fight infections at those luminal surfaces. So there's a variety of mechanisms by which you can manipulate this. And so we've explored those in terms of how to dynamically open and close that barrier with the idea of a normal physiologic function. And one of the things that came about in the 1960s and 70s was a guy named Pappenheimer at Harvard. And what he showed through a variety of different, So what they showed is that if you give nutrients that are selective, that are dependent upon a sodium-dependent transport, that is essential nutrients like glucose, essential amino acids, what you see is you see this kind of, you would expect to see this plateau of what you get. You'd saturate those transport systems that come across. What he found in animals is you got that, you didn't get that. In other words, if you were above the physiologic concentration of the import systems here, above the KM, what you saw was a continued drive of transport across the epithelium. And he could show this in vivo and in vitro. And he showed this from mice to elephants. He showed it in all the species that we think about. Not that I think about elephants on a regular basis. But what he demonstrated was that if you have this thing, and I spent the next couple of years working with a guy named Jim Madera, and we've sorted out the process by which this occurs, and basically what happens is the system is designed to regulate its sodium content very dramatically, very precisely. And these are sodium-dependent systems that drive sodium into the cell, and the sodium has to respond in some way. And the way it does it is it actually exchanges that ultimately for calcium. And the calcium actually ends up building up in the cell. And in doing so, it activates myosin light chain kinase. And myosin light chain kinase works at the tight junction to actually regulate its opening and closed state. Now, in pathologies, constant pathologies, like irritable bowel syndromes, things like that, you'll see an upregulation of myosin light chain kinase function. And you'll see an enhanced regulation or opening of the tight junction on a regular basis, this leaky gut syndrome. And you can correlate that quite carefully with this condition. But in a normal gut, it's usually closed. And the question was, could you manipulate the behavior of the phosphatase to actually open a closed tight junction? So it turns out you can. It's a little complicated of a story because what happens is that the system is designed to stay closed, and there's one kinase that opens this system through the calcium-calmodulin pathway, and we can manipulate that with a small peptide. But to keep it in the closed condition, there's two different systems engaged. And so we wanted to understand more about how to do that if we were going to manipulate it. And that would be to inhibit the myosin light chain. So fortunately, we had the crystal structure of the materials involved. And what we could do is we could design small peptides that were involved in the interfacial interaction between the regulatory domains and the actual phosphatase itself, very specifically. So these peptides are around 12 to 15 amino acids. They're membrane permeate. We put specific amino acids in them, and we make them in the D-reverse sequence so that they're stable in the intestine. And this just shows, I think, where those little peptides are. And one of the peptides that we designed actually ended up being quite nice. One of them, it wasn't so efficient. In other words, it didn't change things too dynamically because it regulates a system which is a fairly slow regulating system. And I'll go back here for a second so you can see that. So this system here, way too many buttons. This system here, This system here actually is the dynamic one. This is a slow regulation. So if you want to let a whole cell get through the tight junction, that's the one you activate and regulate. If you want to just manipulate things during physiologic levels of superphysiologic levels of nutrients, then this is the one that you manipulate on the other side here. And so that bore out quite clearly in the activity of the agents that we picked. And there it is. So what you could see is that if you put that peptide on, you saw a decrease in the resistance properties and an increase in dextrans of 4,000 molecular weight. You took the peptide away, the resistance recurred, the transport immediately dropped. You put the peptide back in again, it dropped again, transport came across. So this is a very dynamic system that we could look at in vivo after we did all these in vitro studies. And in vivo, you can throw insulin in here and you can actually show that it quite dynamically changes blood sugar. And there's no change in the intoxication that you would expect to see if you were actually damaging the epithelium. And you can actually see the insulin in the serum, and you can see that in the portal vein, and then you see it in the systemic circulation later. And you can actually watch the fluorescently labeled dextran, this is the fluorescently labeled insulin, going down between adjacent epithelial cells instead of just sitting at the surface like it normally would. So it's a very quick, dynamic system. But remember, it's working only in that compartment between adjacent cells. So the fact that we're getting just about 3 to 5% bioavailability is not surprising. But what's remarkable about this and what we have to think about the physiology, when you go into any route of delivery of an agent, what happens locally is critical. So although we get only about 3 to 5% bioavailability, we get equivalent to about a 10 to 12% pharmacodynamic response because all of this stuff that comes in goes directly to the liver. So relative to a sub-Q injection for insulin, you get a much more robust response and a more physiologically relevant response. And so that's an important thing about how we think about putting the right place, the right drug in the right place under the right conditions, and you get this added value. And we went on to actually look at the components of that. We had designed this peptide. We went back and looked at all the different peptide elements of it, you know, each amino acid, and looked to see how that affected things. And that was really to understand the biology of this. We could show that our peptide goes into the cells, and it goes right to the tight junction, if you label it. But if you manipulate other components within that, you could decrease its ability to target to the tight junction or target the elements at all. So you can see that this is a very selective system. It only goes to exactly where you want it in the cell. It's a membrane permeate. And so it has the ability to actually function very selectively. And the way that it works is that it actively modulates the system in terms of its ability to manipulate the elements of the tight junction. So this is just a bunch of data. I'm not going to worry about it. More importantly, we could define how it actually does this. And at the tight junction, there's like 60 different proteins, and about 20 of those proteins are actually talking to each other through this Velcro interaction between the adjacent cells. So the question is, how does it actually manipulate that permeability barrier? And it turns out we went through this system and found that there was no change in all of these TAMP components, which is the occludins and the marble 3Ds and those things and tricellulins. But one of the things that it does do is that it actually, you can see that it changes the phosphorylation state of the myosin light chain. So that means that we're getting the activity that we want. We're regulating the phosphatase, but none of these things are changing. But what was important is that only one agent actually does change, and that's Claudin-2. So Claudin-2 is a permeability-enhancing component of the Claudin class of family of proteins at the tight junctions. And what was remarkable is, again, the correlation between the phosphorylation state and the actual increase in the Claudin at the surface allows this permeability change to occur. Now, in understanding the biology of this, it's important to know that Claudin-2 has a positively charged selective function. In other words, under certain conditions, Claudin-2 upregulates and enhances sodium transport. Because remember, sodium comes into the system. It's exchanging for calcium on the bottom of the cell. And the sodium has to go back out to the surface to come back in again with the next nutrient. And so the Claudin-2 rushes to this system, makes it more permeable, and allows the sodium to efflux more efficiently in the system, the process. And so we could actually show that by looking at agents which would control this. And we verified that the speed at which this happened and the way that it happened in terms of its phosphorylation state, all those components worked out very nicely. The pace was appropriate. So it was a very rapid utilization of this system. And we could show that it wasn't the kind of system that you see from this pro-inflammatory thing that I told you about. When things really become damaged by the epithelium, you can add pro-inflammatory agents. You see none of those effects happening here with our stuff, but you see it with these pro-inflammatory things. And the properties of the transport change dramatically. If you open the tight junctions through these pro-inflammatory systems, all kinds of larger molecules, 10,000, 40,000, 70,000 molecular weight dextrans come rushing through. With this system, only about 4,000 molecular weight and below come through. So it's limited. So again, it's a defined system the body uses to enhance its nutrient uptake only at the time that the phosphatase is being dysregulated. Now, here's the thing that was critical is that we then went on and looked to see if there was this charge selectivity of these physiologic interesting agents. So we first put dextrans in a 4,000 molecular weight, whether being positive or negative or neutral charged, and there was a clear benefit to the positive charged ones. The neutral and negative ones moved the same, but the positive charged ones was enhanced very dramatically by this molecule. So we have a system now which is capable of doing what we want, and we verified that by actually taking exenatide and salmon calcitonin. And those agents have very different physiologic PIs. So their isoelectric point is very different, one being a negative charge and one being a positive charge. And we found that the calcitonin was dramatically improved in its uptake by this thing compared to the same size but differently charged exenatide. So again, there's a bias, physiologic bias, to bring positively charged macronutrients through this. And that's probably to do with our diets and what benefits us in terms of survival. This is a system that was set up a long time ago. And so all we're doing is trying to understand how to utilize the system in a dynamic way to to allow macromolecules to get through. And indeed, these are pretty good resistances, pretty good outcomes. You know, you're getting the kinds of effects that you're looking for. But remember, you've got that one area there that you're moving through between adjacent cells. And so if you get anything above 5% bioavailability, you have to kind of question how much damage you're doing to the epithelia, because you're now manipulating in a way that it's not physiologic anymore. So we're happy with this. Whether this is a viable approach for delivery of these kinds of agents will depend upon their applications and their benefits to the patient population in question. But it defines that there are ways that we now can understand how to manipulate these things, and it's not black magic anymore. It's not just you sprinkle permeability enhancers on epithelia and magically things come through and you don't know how or why. We actually really have an understanding, I think, at the beginning now, of understanding how epithelial manipulate these barriers, how they modulate them, how we can manipulate them and modulate them, and the constraints by which they can be used. So this is the concept. So you would, and we've done this now, and we're moving this forward into a pill, oral dosage form study in pigs, and basically the idea of having a material that you want to deliver, the peptide, and so that comes out of a dosage form, and what you're doing is allowing this peptide to come into the cells. It manipulates the phosphorylation state of the myosin light chain. As long as it's at that level by which it is there happening, then you'll get this transport. And with time and distance, I guess, then you're going to start seeing the peptide leaving and going into the body, and we see it just leaving the urine. So it's 11 amino acids. It leaves the urine quite quickly. It's very stable and it's very inert. It works only on this phosphatase from what we can see. Now, that phosphatase is likely in other places in the body, but the issue here is it's at low concentrations. We have the ability to put a high concentration right here just at the level that we need, but once it gets down here into the blood at lower concentrations, it has no physiologic action as we can detect. So the safety looks very good so far in this kind of an approach, and it kind of makes some sense. So in the last bit of time, I'll switch gears and now talk about the idea of what can we realistically do for macromolecules. So I always think of peptides as peptides. I don't think of them as macromolecules, but they are. But the idea is we have a limited group of peptides we actually can administer and that have physiologic function. The problem with those is most of them are quite unstable in the intestine, and we're getting better about making intestinal stable versions of those, but they're no longer physiologic. I mean, now we're playing with Mother Nature, and what does that mean in terms of what their utilization is and their safety and toxicology? But in terms of the macromolecules that we currently inject, there's another parameter here that we have to pay attention to, and that is if we could realistically deliver things across the epithelium and into this compartment and then hit the systemic circulation as we're doing with our PIP peptides, we now are hitting the biggest immune organ in the body. So the gut and the gut axis between its microbiome is what controls, and you've probably seen the literature, you know, the microbiome controls cancer and MS and lupus and RA and all these diseases. And that's really because we're just a vessel by which these bacteria are carried around. And they really are manipulating all of this mucosal immunological environment. And by doing so, they have tremendous impact on all kinds of things in our body. So can we send materials into that site? And once they come into that site, as we learned from the PIP peptides, any small peptide or anything comes in that goes into the blood then goes directly to the liver and then has this hepatoportal system delivery access. But in this case, what happens if you just put materials there? So what we've done is we've figured out how Mother Nature utilizes its microbiome to actually target into that compartment. And it turns out there's a number of bacteria that actually set up chronic infections here. And the reason they do so or want to do so is because they like that compartment. They are there for the long run. And one of the ways that allows them to do that is they secrete virulence factors. These are proteins that move across the epithelia and target selective cells within the lamina propria and ablate their function. So they can either outright kill those cells or they can actually suppress their function. And these proteins have the ability to actually have two things. They actually deliver. Oh, this is wrong. Sorry. There. They have the ability. Jeez. They have the ability to move across. And then once they're there, the carrier that drags this toxic component across has the ability to actually have actions here as well. So what my company has done is designed a method by which we take the carrier component of one of these virulence factors and remove all of the other non-essential components to actually how it transports across the epithelia. And in doing so, we can then couple to it, either through a system which is non-cleavable, a component which wants to reside in that compartment of the lamina propria, or a system which separates the carrier from the cargo and allow the cargo then to enter into the vascular bed to reach the portal system. So as an example of how efficient this system can be, and we have a couple of programs. I'll show you some of them. This is an antibody. This is basically Enbrel. Okay? This is an anti-TNF antibody. And what's remarkable about this, this is in rodents, but essentially 100% of this material comes across. So we put 500 micromoles or picomoles of this material in, and we can get 500 picomoles out of the tissue on the other side. Now, that's a very stable cargo. So antibodies in this system are designed to be stable. Most of the time, we have to formulate to protect the cargo because the cargos in general are not designed to be in this compartment. They look like food. The carrier is designed to be in this compartment. It came from the microbiome and lives in this compartment, and it's evolutionarily designed to actually work here and do everything it's supposed to do. But the efficiency is quite striking. What you can see here is, and again, this is in an inflamed intestine, because many times you need to know that you have patient populations and they're not going to have a happy gut. So some of our first studies are actually to deliver things for ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease. And so we can actually show that this system is actually very nicely functioning in that inflamed environment. But what's remarkable is you can get all this stuff coming across and staying in that compartment, but it doesn't enter the serum. In other words, if you're delivering a really potent agent that would have systemic side effects, it actually can come across, park in the lamina propria, have its actions, and then not have a systemic exposure that limits its safety. And so we can see that if you follow our first program going to the clinic now is IL-10. This is with the location of the carrier. And you can see how efficient the carrier is coming across and the cargo. They're yellow wherever you see them together. So here's the bottom of the epithelial cells, and this is the lamina propria. And you can see all the cells that are labeled there. So a very efficient system. You can see that there's a little bit of reddish here on the surface. That's because the carrier is a little more stable than the IL-10. So what's left out here is probably digested cargo with just the carrier still there, still wanting to come in. But it really is delivered here in terms of this in about 10 minutes. It's a very fast, vesicular trafficked, ATP-driven system. And this is the concept. So what we're doing here is we're saying, look, you can take systemic biologics, you put them in the blood, and a small fragment of them, small amount, get into that lamina propria underneath the epithelia. You can take small molecules and come across, but they don't really stay there. They just keep going through. So if you're going to target this and have an impact on microbiome-related or GI-dependent processes, you're going to miss a big bit of that. And so what we're able to do is actually come in here and deliver things to this compartment and keep them there. And that has a real value. So our first two programs are IL-10 and IL-22. Those will be in the clinic in early next year for a variety of inflammatory diseases. And so this is an opportunity, I think, for us to deliver things directly. We have a system also that we're taking that'll be in the latter stage of 2019, where we take something and deliver it into the hepatic portal system directly. So that's kind of the status of what we're looking at. And I think as drug development people, ultimately drug delivery people have to be drug development people, you have to think about the context of any new technology and what you're doing with it. So our PIP peptides and our the carrier system that AMT is delivering or developing, we have to be cognizant of the fact that this is a new approach and there are safety questions and there's complications. And so you can take molecules that are just well-established targets and you can use those. But they have to have real added value. They have to show some benefit. And we've talked to the regulatory people, and it's great to have a new approach, and that's wonderful. But unless you're adding value to the patient, it's just another biosimilar to them. Okay, it's by a different route. Maybe the convenience is there, but you're not really benefiting the patient. So you have to be careful about picking those targets that actually add added value. We're taking specifically agents that are kind of in this category where they have tremendous upside, but people have not been able to deliver them properly, or they have this systemic rate-limiting toxicity. by putting the missile in this compartment, you have the ability to actually change this property and allow a drug, a promising drug, to become a medicine. So this is the thing that we're actually heading towards. And one of the things that we're really excited about is because we have a tool or tools now to really control the delivery of things into that compartment, either through the peptides to open them up or through this AMT developed system, is we have the ability now to explore that compartment in a way that no one's ever done before, I think. And this is where the biology is now taking us, I think, the idea of now exploring new target opportunities in that compartment, because no one's been able to get them there in a safe and effective way without the toxicity that's related to systemic circulation. So that's where our company is going, and that's kind of the mantra we have. These are the people that have made all that happen, both academically and in the company that I'm associated with. This is now about 45 people instead. But it's a very big effort, but these are the people who have actually been making it happen. So with that, I'll be happy to take questions. Thank you.
You mentioned there was a molecular weight cutoff of around 4,000, yet you're going forward with insulin with the PIP peptide into pigs. So can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's 4 kilodalton dextran. So that's got a big hydrodynamic sphere, bigger than, it carries a big bottle of water with it.
Yep.
So the insulins are actually, you know, they're more compact. So that's probably equivalent to something like a 2 or 3,000 molecular weight dextran.
Okay. Thank you.
Great talk. So I just wanted to ask you a question. Have you ever looked at the glycocalyx layer and how the changes in, because you talked about the changes in salt concentration, how that modulates the tie junction. Have you looked at the changes in glycocalyx layer in healthy and diseased status and see how that correlates with charge screening and the tie junction modulation?
Yeah, so remember the tie junction modulation that we're looking at here, we've only looked at our health conditions so far, the PIP peptides. Because we're looking at agents which would be given chronically to essentially healthy people that are just missing a peptide hormone. So we haven't really explored the sort of any pathophysiology changes that might affect those agents. But, you know, eventually you'd get into type 2 diabetics, probably, let's assume. They do have leaky gut, many of them. They have other issues. That probably isn't going to be too strongly affecting our system, I believe, because it shouldn't. Now, the glycocalyx does have a big impact in terms of the receptor systems that we're using for the AMT technology, because this is all receptor-mediated driven, and those glycocalyx, it's organized with relation to those surface receptors. And so we have looked at that in a variety of disease states, and there we're confident that it actually upregulates slightly in the inflammatory condition, and probably is what Mother Nature had in mind. These bacteria said, it's getting inflamed. I need to send more of this agent in. I need to suppress the immune response that seems to be enhanced in those inflammatory states. So every time we see something in both of these systems, when we step back and say, well, what's the biology here? The biology always works out to be smart for Mother Nature. At least you can hand wave it that way. And it seems to be consistent when we explore it with studies to actually test those questions, is Mother Nature has a really good game plan, and it seems to be all integrated into this process. So I should explain to you more about the PIP peptides and the sodium-dependent function of that. We know that from our IL-22 studies, and a collaborator I have at Harvard, we know that in an inflammation, when IL-22 comes in to fix this system, it upregulates it regulates Claudin-2. But it does it over days because it's fighting a chronic kind of process. This is a very dynamic process. So the process is there, and it's used by Mother Nature in two different ways, one in inflammatory correction and the other one in this dynamic open and closing of hyperpermeable nutrient migration. So the same systems are used over and over.
Hi, John Higgins, Merck. Question for on the first part of your talk. What are the fundamental differences between the mechanism of the peptides you described and like the old school formation enhancers, acyl-carnitine,
yeah,
and sodium caprate and so forth? And then for your second part of your talk, for your delivery of a biologic. Did you say that you're gonna have to deliver that to the gut or to the colon, right?
Yeah, that's, okay, so first question. So the issue there is that we have looked at, I'm blanking on the first question. What's the first? Or isoconazines, those things like that. So what happened is, you know, we have started to go back and look at some of those to see if any of them affect this. And what we can tell, and I have a lot of collaborators we've worked at with this, those really generically disorganize the membrane function. And so you get a disorganization of tight junctions. And the sad thing about that, the difficult thing about it, is that can take 12 to 24 hours to correct. Ours corrects in about 6 minutes, right? And so it's really this rapidly dynamic thing. And the history of those were they just threw things at cells until they saw something work. And unfortunately, when you then take this formulation and you move it to the next species, you have to reformulate all the time because the environment of the intestine keeps changing each time. And you can't, unfortunately, take that into a clinical trial and then reformulate. So you've got to get your best guess, you know, early on, and hope it's safe, and then keep moving it that way. What we did is come from the other direction and say, what's the basic biology? Can we target that? And then we can show that is cross species. It works on all the species we've looked at because we can take all kinds of cells and from all kinds of species and show that the exact same thing is there each time. So that's really how it's different in my mind, is that we don't think there's going to be this complication of moving those agents forward because you're just not sure how they're working and you're not sure why they're working. And in this case, we know exactly how it works and we can show proof of mechanism. The second one was... Oh, yeah. So the cool thing about this is we've identified that there's a lot of lymphocytic trafficking between different layers of the epithelium. So when you teach your immune system of the gut in one location, it actually communicates to other locations. You don't have to do precision bombing in any particular place. You can actually, we want a sort of a pan-colonic delivery, and we have a tool to do that. We have a way to do it. But we don't have to do that in each case. In other words, we still get benefit, it seems, because the lymphocytes talk to the immune system, and they talk to each other, and they move a lot along the intestine.
Randy, a very quick question. Sorry, Anne. One, it's very fast. On commercialization, so one of the great challenges with oral delivery, nasal delivery, and others is variability and exposure. Is there something about your systems that change that?
Yeah, so everybody's been really good at making dosage forms which can allow things to get to these sites very consistently. What we found, I think, are ways to actually consistently manipulate the transcytotic or the paracellular system. So I don't know if you saw this, but, you know, we just squirt this stuff into the intestine, and the error bars are pretty small. And that's quite remarkable in my mind. And what we're seeing in the monkey studies with the oral dosage forms we've used is very tight error bars. Actually, it looks very clean. And that's, again, because it's that last layer. In the past, people have shown a small amount getting through and quite variable. And we're seeing a lot getting through and very consistent because of that endogenous system that's being used.
All right, great. Thank you, Randy.
Thank you very much.
Drug Delivery West is produced by the Conference Forum. The next drug delivery event is the 8th Annual Pod Conference happening October 17th through the 19th in Boston. To get on our mailing list for future drug delivery podcasts, email us at service@tcfllc.org. And for more information about our drug delivery conferences, visit us at theconferenceforum.org. Thanks for listening.